Chugga 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 choo choo. Welcome to the Uproar in the Studio podcast. We are pulling into the station this week. I'm Noah.
I'm Reza.
I'm Andrew, and this is the Jackie Chan post Rush Hour 3 season.
This week we're talking about Railroad Tigers, released in 2016. You don't have to see it, we're gonna give a synopsis, but if you want to watch it without spoilers, listen to the show afterwards.
Later, we'll have a conversation with Michael C. Pizzuto, a voice actor and dubber who does so many voices in Railroad Tigers, he does not remember who he played. He tells us about the life of a dubber in Hong Kong.
The life and the love of a dubber in Hong Kong.
But first, we're talking about the movie with four-time guest, reigning champ, last king of Scotland, poet Yi Wu. Here's our conversation, starting with a synopsis.
In this highly stylized World War II action comedy, Jackie Chan stars as Ma Yuan, a Robin Hood figure stealing supplies from Japanese trains to distribute to the occupied Chinese. He and his ragtag group of improvisational warriors, known as the Railroad Tigers, find themselves called to bigger ambitions when a wounded Chinese soldier tells them about a thwarted plan to destroy a rail bridge crucial to the Japanese military supply chain. The Railroad Tigers accept the challenge and spend the rest of the film stocking up on supplies and finally leading a siege to bring the bridge down. Train hijinks, transit museums, and some classic Jackie Chan action. This is Railroad Tigers.
So, I guess to launch in, what'd you guys think of the movie?
I want to be as charitable as possible, but it wasn't as memorable as I expected it to be, unfortunately. I mean, there are some bright points, but
I think as a movie maker, if you want to make a movie that's like into three acts and then, you know, each act gets better, this is probably the best movie of all time, right? Because like compared to the first act, the third act is just, it's like Tarkovsky versus fucking Michael Bay. Even though the end is probably more Michael Bay than anything.
But it's better than Michael Bay, I think. The first 50 minutes of this movie are like possibly the worst 50 minutes of a movie I've seen.
I would say that's a push, but I would say the first like 20 minutes are the worst 20 minutes of any movie we've seen for the show.
Yeah.
Just introducing the whole ensemble of like 40 people and like giving them live action cuts or like animated cuts.
Yeah. That was pretty goofy.
It's a bit much. With their like tagline, like anybody cares or pays attention.
They try to add some comedic element to it, but like, I don't think it's even a good comedy.
Because it doesn't circle around. It's not like these characters repeatedly say these things. Like,
well, no, okay, because there's the one line that Jackie Chan says, which is talk less. But it doesn't seem to pay off as a joke. It feels like they're setting
up. My subtitles were shut up.
Okay, interesting. In any case, there's no payoff to that running gag.
None.
It's not even a gag. It's just,
it's just something he says.
Yeah.
So I don't know about that choice of direction. It starts off weird, right? It's like an Australian lady. Though there's a good payoff to that, I guess.
Yeah, with Andy Lau at the end.
Yeah, and then why? I think the subtext is that, remember in the very beginning, it says the Western sun is going to set, right?
Mm.
Is that like a shading of like the West? Like they introduce an Australian lady and then he said the song story, like the Western sun's gonna set. I don't know. I mean, Japan is not really a part of the West.
Although they thought of themselves as the West.
I think in like this context it is, right? Because I think by the West, it's like, I want to say the white man, but it doesn't really work here. But like, you know, the conqueror, the imperialist, the fascist.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just like not super comfortable with that. But I should say like for the entire movie, like there's a lot of things I feel uncomfortable with. But that's the one opening scene is that it seems that it's as if like the anti-Japanese effort is trying to impress white Westerners. You know, if you get that vibe.
Do you think it was made for white Westerners to feel that way, or more for the Chinese to feel that way?
mean, I think it's the latter. Well, I mean, it's a film made by the Shanghai Movie Company, something like that. I mean, I can't translate the name, but it was made for a domestic audience, I suppose.
Exactly, I don't think this really made an effort to be an international movie, which a lot of the time I appreciate.
But they dubbed it, though, somehow.
Did you watch a dub version of it?
Yeah, and it kind of takes away the way the interpreter, like the dub, or I don't know how to say it, what's the term for it?
It is a dubber. We just spoke to one last night.
Yeah, it'll be on the show right after this conversation.
Oh, really? I don't know. Like, I felt they kind of, I don't mean to diss them or anything, but like, I felt that as someone who can speak Chinese, it kind of takes away from the ferocity of the original. I felt almost like the way the dubber talks is almost fun in a place that shouldn't be funny.
Yeah.
Although that must be the case a lot of the time, though.
The tone of the movie overall is, like, weirdly lighthearted. Even when they're, like, recuperating after getting off that island, and he's talking about why he has that pipe, and he's like, oh, my father was smoking it when the Japanese killed him, and then my wife was stuffing it with tobacco for me when they killed her.
And, but, like, you're supposed to laugh, almost.
Yeah, and he's like, so I carry this pipe around now. I'll never forget, but he's kind of smiling. Like, it's as if he's telling a funny anecdote at dinner.
You know? And I don't think that would work if it was anybody but Jackie Chan. And, like, I think him doing that made this movie a lot more enjoyable for me, because I think, as we see in the season, there are just some movies it really doesn't seem like he's having fun making, right? Whereas here, it just seems like he loves fucking up.
I mean, he didn't fight much until the end, really.
No one did, right?
Not much kung fu. Like, I mean, that's what you expect for Jackie Chan. But, I mean, I think there might be a reason for it, and I will talk about the reason in a bit. But, like, what do you guys think first?
I mean, I think it's what we've seen all season. It's him getting old, and this is one of the ensemble movies that has become his primary action genre now. It's like a team, and he's sort of the team leader, but he doesn't do a lot of the action. Very much like Chinese Zodiac, Kung Fu Yoga, and Vanguard that's coming up. It's his new mode. What did you think, Yi?
I was just thinking about, again, I'm not super in touch with current Chinese popular culture, but I sometimes read about it. There is something called, for the domestic audience, there is a type of TV show that's often derided by the people on the internet. It's called Kang Ri Shen Ju. It roughly translates as anti-Japanese mythological show. I mean, it's called mythological shen, means like miraculous, like fantasy. Mm-hmm. It means that there's a type of show that shows World War II scenes against Japan, and they're often very over the top in portraying Chinese soldiers as pretty much invincible. They're very action packed, and they fight a lot. And then the Japanese soldiers were shown as really incompetent. They can't shoot. They always get shot. You know, it's like a James Bond movie, but with those mooks as Japanese troops. So one of the meme from that was that there was a scene where one of the Chinese soldier threw a grenade and it blew up.
Yeah.
It blew up an airplane. It blew up an airplane on the air. And the other scene was like one guy he was holding a Japanese soldier and like just used hand pulled a person into two pieces just by hand. Yeah. So like scenes like that really.
I think that's humanly possible.
It really kind of...
I haven't been to Dagestan, but it's probably possible.
It's possible that Jackie Chan and the directors and who the producers trying to avoid being perceived like that. So they kind of did tamp down the action, at least in the beginning. And they didn't... Although I would say that the incompetent Japanese is still present in even in this movie. I think because in real life, in World War II, like Japanese soldiers were very competent. They're very good fighters. It's more realistic than the more dramatic TV shows for Chinese consumption in the domestic media. But it should not be viewed as a historical World War II film. But it's
of course, because it's not.
Yeah,
you know, it's not based off something real, right? So I don't think it has to contend with that kind of issue that you're talking about.
Although those sound like they're fictional shows too, within that like historical moment.
Yeah. So I will say it tries to be slightly more realistic than the more over-the-top, more propagandistic World War II TV shows and films inside China, but I don't think it does a good job in that.
Though when the PLA shows up and absolutely destroys the Japanese, like, that was...
So is that guy, you know, the one guy who's, like, the sharpshooter, I couldn't tell if he was PLA soldier or a KMT soldier.
I mean, I don't think it matters. I think it's, like, defending the homeland. Like, he was fighting the occupation, right?
No, but it's interesting because, like, most of the fighting against the Japanese wasn't the communists in World War II, right?
Yeah.
And they sort of paper over that in this movie. It's not very clear what the national politics are within China. It's just fighting for the homeland. It's I'll just die for my country.
Which is, like, at that stage, like, the most important political consideration, right?
Correct. And, well, when I read about the plot in, like, the introduction elsewhere, it seems to say that they're communist soldiers. Like, they call it the Eighth Army. Have you heard of Eighth Army?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they repeatedly talk about that, yeah.
Yeah, so... I mean, they're wearing a red armband in the scene, so it seems they were the communist army, which I think connects to... This film was made in 2016, mm-hmm. and in 2015, a year before, it was the official Chinese military parade for the Victory Day. Uh-huh. And I think there could be some connection in there where, so in that Victory Day parade, I think it was officially called the Anti-Fascist Parade, where mm-hmm. President Xi Jinping and he invited a bunch of world leaders to observe a Chinese army parading through Tiananmen Square. I think, and I think Putin attended.
Of course, Trump did.
Obama did not. Oh, that was Obama. Trump wasn't in power yet.
Yeah.
So Obama refused to. I think he might have been invited, but he did not go to Beijing to attend. I think Putin was the only like European. Well, he's not even European. I think the only Western Europe, Eastern European leader that other than Putin was. Miloš Zeman, the president of Czech Republic.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think Orban was there. And
It wasn't too early, I think.
Western, not too early.
No major Western leaders were present, like Obama or Cameron and any of those guys. They were not there so because they didn't want to appear in the military parade in Tiananmen Square, I suppose.
Well, also, like, World War II, I think, it's faded much more so in the West, whereas in at least Russia, and I guess with movies like this and the taking of Tiger Mountain a few years before, it's much more present, I think, in the culture for people who really fucking suffered from it.
I also think in, like, the Anglo canon, China plays such a small role in the war. I think the way we're taught World War II is kind of like, you know, China's just taken and like that's like the extent to which we learn about it.
I think to a large extent they were like the nationalists were sort of like the French.
No, actually, yes, that's not true. That's something I'll have to correct record because that's something else. When I was a college student, one of my roommates basically they were talking about World War II. I said that there were resistance in China and that person pretty much told me that it's like the French resistance where it's all underground and kind of like anemic. While I was saying that Japanese soldiers were highly competent and very good fighters, that doesn't mean the resistance was, they had much worse equipment and they were not as trained as a fighting force, but they did do a fairly good job in fighting back Japanese. It's in the sense that unlike the French, the entire China was never entirely off. Was never occupied mm-hmm. at the same time. Like, because French, we have the Vichy France,
Northern France.
They had
the Free French. France
and Vichy France.
Yeah.
But in the KMT, when you talk about it, the Nanking was invaded and occupied by the Japanese, and they committed the Nanking Massacre inside Nanking. That was the previous capital. And so Chiang Kai-shek and the KMT moved to a place called Chongqing. Have you heard of Chongqing?
Yeah.
I can give you a little bit of the primer on the city. It's an interesting city to visit. But Chongqing, my dad had been there. It's a very mountainous city. So if you go there and travel, you have to pretty much drive on a lot of hilly roads to get around. And it's known for spicy food. So if you like eating spicy food, you should visit Chongqing. But Chongqing was the capital. Contemporary capital of Chiang Kai-shek, he moved there. While there was a public government, but it's not as influential as the Vichy France. It was in the episode about 1911. Mm-hmm. I talk about that guy. His name was Wang Jingwei. He appeared in the 1911 another Jackie Chan film. Made some cameo appearances.
The Suit Man.
Yeah, the Suit Man. Yeah, he was previously involved in a political struggle inside KMT with Chiang Kai-shek to kind of trying to become Sun Yat-sen's successor, and he lost. So he collaborated with Japanese during World War II to set up a puppet government in Nanking, while the other puppet government was Manchukuo, Manchuria, headed nominally by the last emperor.
So, oh, the child.
Well, at
not
time,
at that was, point.
I mean, he is forever the child.
Yeah, the child. So you have pretty much two puppet governments, one by Wang Jingwei, one by Emperor Puyi, and Chiang Kai-shek, the KMT, and the communists, they are both, the communists play much a lesser role. You know, the Eighth Army is only one army out of many. And I think several hundreds of commanders who you would say generals from the KMT had died in the resistance campaigns. And I think a few, like a single-digit number of communist generals died in the struggle. So it's the KMT played an outsized role despite the current propaganda and the portrayal in Victory Day parade that the communists played a huge role. But in reality, the KMT was the major force. And so the entire China was never occupied as a whole. And to be fair, like the nuclear break on Japan did kind of end the war, but by that point, the Japanese troop in China was stretched very thin, and pretty much the entire Japanese force was stranded in China. In the end of the war, like you see, Japan was sending soldiers who are 15 into the war. Like, you know,
they'd also proposed a conditional surrender before the bombing.
I mean, the war was over.
Yeah,
it was kind of like Cold War Act One.
Yeah, exactly.
Think about how, like, when MacArthur and when American troops were fighting Japan in the Southeast, it was in Philippines and in Burma.
Well, Burma's British, right?
Yeah. But like in the other parts of Asia, when American and British soldiers went in, they pretty much took those places easily. Like, yeah. I think the only fierce battle was at one of the islands called I forgot what it was, but in one of the islands there was a. The Battle of Saipan, something like that, was really fierce. Mm-hmm. But on other battles, there was not a lot of effort by American and British to fight Japan. That's because the best Japanese soldiers were in China, and they were bogged down by the very fierce resistance of the Chinese army. So it's like to characterize it as French resistance, it's kind of unfair, you know.
Sure, but this movie in particular takes place in occupied China, and it's interesting because it seems to be in a way almost I don't know if it's, you know, on purpose a takeoff on this movie, but it seems to be almost like a transposed to China remake of John Frankenheimer's The Train, starring Burt Lancaster, which came out in the 60s, and that is about French resistance fighters taking a train and wreaking havoc, and the movie itself seems to offer that sort of parallel with films about the French resistance.
Oh, actually, I've never seen that one. Reza, have you seen that movie, Reza?
I haven't, but I mean, it's not like an outlandish theme, right, for an occupied force to use. I mean, trains, what else can you do, right? I understand where you're coming from, and like I'm sure that in some capacity played a role in the making of this, but
I don't know, I'm just saying there's a movie with a very close parallel plot.
Yeah, but it's just not like it's not a crazy plot, I guess, is the point that I would make. It's a good plot.
It is a good plot. Or at least in the last third of this movie, it's a good plot.
I genuinely, like, really choked up when the PLA showed up at the end. Because, like, it was so hopeless, and, like, I had just gotten into the movie because it just decided to be good all of a sudden. And then all of a sudden, these guys just, like, pull up with machine guns and shit, like, just knocking Japanese down. That was beautiful.
Well, I don't know, that's kind of like a Deus Ex Machina kind of thing. I didn't completely. The other thing I'm confused about, like, why the train keep running when when the fights are already on, like, people being killed, like, being shot, and there are tanks were being dropped from the train, and the train just, like, continued to run. Like, what's going on? Like, who was driving the train? You know?
It's Japanese engineering, man.
Yeah, so okay.
Well, to the point of who was running the train, JC was running the train for much of this movie, which I don't think we can not talk about JC Chan in this movie.
I think he set off the pulley scene with JC and Jackie was one of my favorite Jackie slapstick scenes for the season. And the fact that JC is kind of like the leader of that, I think gives me hope that he can carry on the legacy or something, because that was great. And JC in general throughout this movie was super solid.
He plays like second string village idiot, I think, behind the big guy.
He's probably the focal character, I think. I mean, obviously it's Jackie, but like, he's given a lot of camera time. He plays, you know, he drives the train, both of them.
But this is also the last movie that JC made with Jackie in 2016. Like, he hasn't been brought back for some reason.
You think Jackie's jealous that JC's good?
I don't know, like, father and son shouldn't be in the movie together, but at the same time, I think without all the scandals surrounding the father, JC should be more famous.
Well, I mean, JC also had his major scandal. He went to jail for a while, literally just for letting people smoke weed at his house, which, like...
Well, I heard rumors from, like, the overseas Chinese media that them going after his son was because JC was involved in political... Like, he was connected with some arrested corrupt official, and they were trying to teach him a lesson by arresting his son, because, I mean, Jackie Chan was probably too old to use drugs himself. So,
Joke's on law enforcement, because he hates his son.
Like, the fact is that from what I read on, like, in the online, I mean, I've not been in China for a long time, but, like, from what I read online, like, a lot of Chinese entertainers smoke weed, like, which is the same as American entertainers. Why him? You know, like, have you heard of the phrase Chaoyang Qunzhong?
No.
So Chaoyang is a district in Beijing that's one of the more well-to-do places, and Qunzhong means like mass of the people. So Chaoyang Qunzhong means people of the district. Then often when a movie star or an entertainer or singer was arrested for drugs, the police would always say Chaoyang Qunzhong, the people of this district, reported them. Like, why? Like, Do you see people in the U.S. like calling the police because their neighbor was smoking weed? Like, doesn't happen. So, you know, like when you say like somebody reported them, you know, that's suspicious. You know, it's most likely like, you know, some police hired an informant to report it later to create an impression that it were reported by just some randos who are in their neighborhood.
You know? Do you want to talk about the corrupt official that Jackie was connected with? Because that's a story I've heard before, but that's not something we've delved into on this season, which we should.
Oh, yeah. So Chongqing, the city that was the capital of temporary capital of Chiang Kai-shek, that was actually relevant to this, because there was a famous Chongqing official named Bo Xilai.
Mm-hmm.
He was the party boss of Chongqing, kind of like above the mayor. He was the son of a famous revolutionary on the communist side, and he was kind of a rising star, but he was seen as challenging he was a very bad guy. Like there was a lot of criminal allegations against him, including murder, but he was kind of seen as a challenge to the eventual success of the Xi Jinping. There was a scandal erupted about him that his wife murdered a British merchant named Neil Haywood. So he was arrested, and his wife was arrested for murder, and he was arrested for corruption, and probably, I'm not sure what the charges were, but like maybe they thought he was aiding and abetting the murder of this foreign British guy. So Britain of course demanded an investigation. So he was arrested and sentenced to life imprisonment for various charges. And then that kind of opened up the salvo of a broad anti-corruption campaign ever taken by China. But at the time, Xi Jinping wasn't in power yet. Like, Hu Jintao was arresting Bo Xilai. And there are some rumors that Jackie Chan was very friendly with Bo Xilai. Actually, let me look it up right now to make sure that I'm not just spewing bullshit.
Elsewhere too. Yeah,
I've read about the Bo Xilai like Haywood case before, but I don't.
I've heard about the Jackie connection before.
I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, so like a lot of Chinese websites like about actually in 2008, Bo Xilai's son Bo Guagua invited Jackie Chan to participate in activities in Oxford University. So yeah, he definitely knew Bo Xilai and was very friendly. But I think the worst wasn't even with Bo Xilai, though. He was also very friendly with this man named Zhou Yongkang. Have you heard of Zhou Yongkang?
No.
So Zhou was the former police minister of like public security minister of China, and later on he was like head of this party committee in charge of the judicial system. So imagine like if there's one guy, one official in the United States who is the boss of the Supreme Court, just Chief Justice, the Attorney General, and as well as in charge of all district attorneys in the U.S. Like, what kind of official would that be?
Yeah.
No one.
A competent one.
Not in this case.
The Chinese legal system is very different from the American one, where like the party is above the justice system. So like he was the party official representing the party to supervise the justice system. So
yeah.
All the police department, all the district attorneys, and all the judges have to listen to him. So he, of course, like he used this opportunity to be extremely corrupt, and he was in charge of both the public police and secret police. So a lot of the human rights violations were supervised by him. And allegedly, he was involved in a plot to take down Xi Jinping and put someone else in charge, named possibly Bo Xilai or someone he favors, because he had like very grand political ambitions. So he was arrested and also sentenced to life imprisonment. So, and there was a picture of him with Jackie Chan. So allegedly, Jackie Chan was very friendly with him as well, which makes sense because Jackie Chan often portrayed like policemen.
He's so, like, the icon of the Chinese very, cop now.
Pretty much, like, he's very connected to cops. So, like, and Zhou Yongkang was the former chief cop of China and doing extreme, like, pretty much, like, in the U.S., there isn't, like recently we heard about all the, well, there was a lot of protests about extreme police brutality in the United States, but those protests are about systematic racism. There's not, like, one official, like, one guy in charge of police brutality, right? But in China, I mean, police brutality, of course, is much worse in China and is supervised by, like, a small group of officials. And Mr. Zhou was kind of the head of all of that. So you could say all of police brutality in China, responsibility rests on someone like that. So,
although his removal hasn't resulted in an end of police brutality.
Yeah, I mean, the party system was I mean, it's a very authoritarian system. It's a very different one from the American one. But at least you could say that in the U.S. it's like kind of disseminated police brutality, not like a centralized apparatus that is designed to brutalize people.
Would you say that arrest was what turned the tide and like turning Xi Jinping's kind of... actually, this is before Xi Jinping, isn't it? Haywood's death?
Haywood's death was before Xi Jinping.
Yes. Yeah,
that was Hu Jintao. But Xi Jinping kind of...
The big anti-corruption drive.
Kind of took over that and to use that momentum to go after the other people who were close to Bo Xilai or to factions that were opposing him. And, you know, like, because you could say that after the so-called economic reform of China, a lot of officials were extremely corrupt and they capitalized on the crony capitalism aspect of the Chinese economy and really enriched themselves on the expense of everyone else. So yeah, I'm not going to be sympathetic towards those arrested because, I mean, they most of them probably deserved it.
Maybe not JC, though.
Yeah, not JC. Like, I mean, JC is not involved in any corruption. I mean, I would assume, like, he's young. Like, I don't think he...
Yeah, his like, only crime was putting out a bunch of bad rom-coms and Canto Pop albums.
His only crime is having a bad father.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, the relationship between Jackie and JC as laid out in Jackie's autobiography was they were never close. Like, JC grew up in L.A. while Jackie was in China. Jackie apparently dropped JC when he was a child. You know, not exactly a great father, even on a personal level, it seems like. And then to have these political connections come back and hit the kid kind of sucks.
Should have just stayed in L.A., man. Right. Actually, I'm sure he leads a better life out there. Well, I guess not anymore.
Yeah. If I were JC, I would have denounced my father and kind of ran to the Hollywood. You know, I just... Chinese politics is so opaque that you can't really... As an outsider, like, if you are not, like, an insider, you really should not be involved in power struggles. Like, I think JC was just, like, a victim of that.
I mean, he could have just been in exile in L.A. and been, like, Reza Shah or something. Just, like, stage like a bullshit coup or try to stage a bullshit coup. JC should take up politics.
Well, the thing about JC is I don't think he would have...
Because he's got a platform.
He's 37.
Which is easy to tap into.
And, like, you would think that his platform would be easy to tap into, but, like, his first solo movie where he was the lead made $9,000. I think JC hasn't taken advantage of his platform even before all the political shit happened. Or, like, yeah. He tried to take advantage of it. Initially, he tried to go to college, too. I was reading about this earlier. He lasted 2 semesters at William & Mary and was like, I'd rather drive fast cars and fuck around in China. He's fair. Quoted saying this. So, like, he's an interesting figure just in that he's very much Jackie Chan's fail son, but also, like, the victim of this political system.
Should keep an eye on this guy.
Right. And yet he's good in this movie, I think.
Oh, he's great in this movie. And I thought he was great in 1911, too, for, like, you know,
he's there for a couple of seconds, right?
Yeah, what I didn't notice he was there in 1911.
He's like a minor soldier.
When they
soldier.
Staged the siege on the governor's mansion, he ordered the attack and, like, raised the flag, the resistance.
Yeah, as he's gotten older, he's started to look more and more like his dad, I think. His nose has kind of, like, I don't know, become more like his dad's as time has gone on. And they talk about that in the movie, too. In this movie, they're like, oh, you got a big nose, I got a big nose. While they're being interrogated.
I have a question, like, how did Jackie Chan get in that, how did he get captured in that jail, that the cage that the Japanese put in him? Like, how, because he was captured after one of the other guys just start getting beaten up on the streets. Like, what that happened? I didn't get that part.
Yeah, it was very chaotic. I have no idea what was happening there.
Why did they just start beating up people on the streets?
I think the implication is that they're Japanese.
Ah.
I think it's playing into that sort of propaganda. They'll just beat people on the streets.
They'll just do anything. They're occupiers.
Right.
Yeah. And it's effective. I mean.
But it's interesting that this movie, 6 years.
Wasn't necessary, though.
But, like, 6 years after Shinjuku Incident, this movie comes out. And Shinjuku Incident is a movie that tries, like, it has human Japanese characters. It has, like, Japanese characters that you can relate to and feel good about.
That was way much more of a, like, bowing down to the Japanese movie.
I don't know, right? About that, but it's, like, much more cooperative with the Japanese. And, like, 6 years later, that he's turning to this historical period is interesting, I think.
I think the context is, in those 6 years, the Chinese economy probably doubled.
That's true.
No, like, legitimately, yeah. Empirically, you know? So, like, I think in those 6 years, a lot had changed, and from becoming a migrant worker, he's... leading the resistance.
I didn't say Shinjuku Incident, but from 1911 to the railroad to this movie, I think the cinematography deteriorated. I think.
Oh, for sure. But this is very much in the vein of 1911 narratively.
Although I think the action in this one is more coherent. Like, I think the action
1911
sequence...
was just kind of a spectacle, like, to watch. It was a great movie to watch, but, like, not too coherent.
Right, exactly. It was sort of filled with the chaos of revolution, and this one is sort of a heist movie almost.
Yeah, this movie promotes terrorism.
Yeah, dude, they're Antifa.
Yeah, well, I don't know. This is not my other question.
Is the Antifa super soldier
with a Antifa beard. Very much. A little bit wispy.
How does this film to you, like, resemble older, like, Western, like, train jacking movies?
Train heists?
Train heists, yeah. Like, the Western train heists, like, in the Wild West in the United States.
Oh, I mean, I don't know that this one so much works out like that, because those are, like, shock and awe type train takeovers. This is more sneaky.
This is a military, like, movement, right? Like, they're taking out the bridge to cut the supply line, which they don't know they're doing until, like, halfway into the movie. But it's not, like, a disruptive, like, we're fucking with them. This is, like, we're taking over for the platoon that couldn't make it.
But, like,
to prove to my wife that I can do something. My dead wife.
But, like, until they know that they're going to have to blow up the bridge, the movie has no momentum. Like,
which makes sense, because, like, they're just aimlessly going to blow up a bridge at that point.
Right. I don't know. I think this would be an amazing 70-minute movie. if you just cut off the first part.
Yeah, it's 2 hours, right?
Right. I mean,
there were certain plot elements that didn't really need to be there, like, you know, the whole, like, little love story with the pancake lady, who was nice, and I like that, like, gag they did with the Japanese flag.
And
the
drugging
poison.
That guy? Yeah, that was really funny, I thought.
But I think the investment into that plot line really took away from the rest of the movie, and it wasn't as necessary. It didn't have to be so fleshed out.
Although, I think what it does do that's effective is in the first half, it makes that main Japanese guy sort of, it makes him sort of intimidating, and then the second half, we were talking about Japanese and grenades earlier, like, he fumbles the grenade back into the boat and, like, almost blows himself up.
How did he survive? That's the question.
He dived into the water. He was a good swimmer.
There was that line, like, how does that Japanese devil, like, not die or whatever? And he's always fine.
Like, didn't he, like, because I saw him, he was trying to stand up and he fell backwards or something like that, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. But he was like alive and well and uninjured afterwards. Like, he's still being able to walk.
Yeah, he was soot covered, but otherwise he was okay.
If anyone in this movie repeats like a slogan, it's him, and all he says is "you hicks." That's all he says.
Yeah, the subtitle that I found the funniest was in parentheses Japanese, "you hicks."
didn't he like? Well, he failed so many times. Why didn't he commit to seppuku? Right? Yeah.
Well, there's that guy who fails to commit seppuku in this movie.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it is like a oddly goofy movie for the subject matter.
Also, by far the funniest gag to me, or among the funniest gags certainly, was where they're like Jackie Chan's group, the Railroad Tigers, encounter the Japanese soldiers in the other boat, and they just like start shouting "banzai, banzai," and the Japanese start shouting it back. And they row away.
And they, like, bow. I think it's a funny movie, actually. In certain parts, were definitely funny.
Yeah, it had laughs.
What do you think about that female Japanese soldier? Like, I kind of liked her.
She's also a Chinese kind of a actress, like, which is weird, too. Like, some of the Japanese in the movie are Japanese, but they cast her as... She's, like, a regular in Jackie Chan movies. She's part of the team in Chinese Zodiac. She's the bad henchwoman in Skip Trace. She's in a lot of these. And so, like, it seems strange to me that they cast a Chinese actress in that role.
Well, because she's the only Japanese soldier who actually can fight.
Yeah. She was, like, a Taekwondo champion, too, the actress.
I think they just get her on screen. I think she's really good. I think, their pairing with JC throughout like the last bit of the movie was
that was really funny, where he's pretending to let the steam out. Whoa. And she's like reacting to the non-existent
steam. And she's got like
steam.
Yu-Gi-Oh hair at that point too.
Yeah, cool.
She gave off like Azula vibes
for some reason. I've been watching this, I just keep thinking back to what if a James Bond movie is not as good as James Bond movie, like The Japanese soldiers are worse than a James Bond MOOC. Yeah.
I think there is an emphasis on these being, like, lower-class characters, working-class people, porters at the train station, rather than, say, like the difference between this and the train, that Vichy Resistance movie, is that in that one, the heroic character is the station manager, played by Burt Lancaster. But in this one, it's the porters. I think that's a huge difference.
That's a conscious decision, right? Like the content. Yeah.
But like as a contrast with the James Bond movies where it's, I mean, there's some implication that he grew up in an orphanage or whatever, but like as Skyfall insists, he is deep down upper class. He is essentially an aristocrat.
Yeah. So the communist still wants to be communist.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Like these are not the Sun Yat-sen Chinese. These are the Mao Zedong Chinese.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, 2016 though, but that's like if this movie was made in the 1970s, I would say it's genuine. But in 16, I feel that's. I mean, also like the fact that Jackie Chan didn't really play he's not even that convincing as a working class person.
Yeah.
Like, because there are people who actually can play the work. Remember, like, Detective Chinatown? I think there was the main character in that movie, the actor, he was known for playing the working class, and Jackie Chan isn't.
Hmm.
Wong Bo-chan, yeah, he's... let me see. What...
Oh, one thing we haven't talked about and should is the, like, the landmark bullet tracking scene in this.
Yeah, that makes this way better than any James Bond movie ever. Literally that's just what I, following that's what I really cannon bullet. In,
when they just like shot like the cannon into the train carriage and just let the bullet track happen from there, it was just like,
yeah,
damn, like they really love this shit.
That reminds me of the bullet track in the thing is, I'm not sure how to compare that with the bullet track in Matrix.
Yeah. Oh, I was comparing it to, you know, Wolf Warrior 2.
Yeah. Wolf Warrior 2. Oh, yeah. I have watched Wolf Warrior 2, and I would say, like, that was much better made than this.
Well, certainly. Oh, it's also a couple years later than this.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, momentum of a train, and I guess, like, the not to take anything away from the action in Wolf Warrior 2, but I think, like, just the fact that this is, such, like, one long sequence at the end is... very compelling, I thought. That they stick definitely with their mission. And
once
it's...
they're on that final train, the movie really, that's when the movie starts.
Exactly. Which is, like, tragic that and we had to sit through the rest of it.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk about Andy Lau at the end. Like, as the school teacher. What?
Oh, Andy Lau.
He's not the school teacher, he's the dad.
Is he? He's credited as a school teacher on IMDb.
He's totally the kid's dad.
They just want Andy Lau to be there for him.
Right.
For like, the credit. Yeah. Like, he used to be a singer, like, before he was an actor, I think. Like, he was when I was a kid, he was really big as a singer, at least in the Chinese audience.
But he'd already been in, like, Infernal Affairs and stuff, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm a little bit lost on the chronology of this now. Yeah, I don't think there's any Chinese person in China that does not know him.
Yeah.
He's like Jackie Chan, but probably better.
Do you think he's politically better? Because I was like, when I saw him in this movie, I was like, who did he owe a favor to? Right? Like, he just delivers basically a propaganda line at the end of the movie.
I mean, he's probably just chilling in, like, Australia, and, like, why not get him in the shot?
Well, I don't remember what his political stances about, but he's definitely not pro Hong Kong democracy. That I know. Like, if he were, he would have been boycotted in China right now.
Right, and instead he's in this movie.
As always, huge thanks to Yi Wu. Up next is our conversation with Michael C. Pizzuto, dubber on Railroad Tigers.
How did you start getting involved in dubbing Chinese movies?
I guess it was about 2007, and I moved out to Hong Kong, and I had gone out there for what was supposed to be just a one-year adventure, and I was working with a theater company out there, and it ended up being that I stayed there for almost 13 years. So I went out to Hong Kong, and I was involved with a theater show out there, and some people saw me in a show, and they asked me if I had any interest in animation voice work and dubbing. Any actor would reply, yeah, definitely, of course, I'm very interested in animation work. And they said, well, you know, we do a lot of dubbing for both live action and animation here in Hong Kong. It's a full-time gig. If you get it, we'd like to have you come and audition. And so that was when I was thinking that I was just going to be there for 1 year. So when I did audition and I got that full-time gig, I ended up saying, okay, 2 years. 2 years, and then that's it. And I'm back to the States. So, but I just started dubbing then full-time. It was a combination of everything from live action, both Chinese films and also other foreign country films, to English. It would be also animation, video games, what they call localizing a video game. For example, if a game that I did, Earth Defense Force, was originally made in Japanese, but they would what they would call localize it add an English version. So you're actually dubbing a video game that's already been created. Just became a full-time job, really. I found myself deciding to come out to Los Angeles, and that's what I've been doing out here as well.
Was it one company that you were working with the whole time?
The way that they'll do that, what they'll call it, you know, ADR work, and that is when if you have the actual star coming in to do voice work, they'll have their own separate time and their own scheduled studio time, and so they won't be, you know, in there with the peasants such as myself. They'll have their own, you know, Perrier waiting for them and all. But for the most part, all the dubbing that I did was going to be for the English version. So it was very rare that you would have a star of a foreign film doing the English version dubbing. You know, they would do that on their own for something else. There's another whole side of it for Chinese films, but not just Chinese films, but all different kinds of films. And that is what we would call looping and walla sessions. It's not necessarily dubbing it to English, but it's adding extra ambiance to a film. Like, for example, they may choose a person's face to be the waiter in a Chinese film, and it's a gorgeous Russian model, and that's the face they wanted. But he just can barely speak a word of English. He was stumbling through his lines, and he didn't, you know, or in those kind of situations, they need a voice actor to come in and redo the lines. So for countless films, especially ones made in China, I would come in and I would give an articulate voice to someone who could barely speak English, but was cast strictly based on their looks. And if the scene was supposed to be in English, because every once in a while there'll be a scene like that. They'll film it as if the people in China went off to Europe for a business meeting or something. And they'll just get different Caucasian people who happen to live in mainland China with zero acting experience and perhaps very little grasp of the English language to act out the scene. And the other side of that is what you call the walla and looping. For example, if let's say there's a scene in the Chinese film where they are at a French cafe and it's supposed to be in Paris, France, or it's supposed to be in London, England, right? And of course it was filmed probably in Guangzhou or something with as many foreigners as they could throw in the background. And they would need voices later put into the film. So when you're filming that scene, only the actors that are on the screen are the ones that are talking. All the background extras are 100% silent. And what they will do is they'll rely on what they call the loopers or the walla team to then later go in and add crowd voices. Hey, can you pass the salt? Sure. Yeah, I'll take the steak dinner. Yeah, what would you like? Okay, I'll order that. It's like that for everything. And I do a lot of that for film and television here in the States as well.
Is that different in terms of casting from a speaking role or a principal role in an audition sense, or are you part of a company of loopers or of walla people?
It's a very different world in Los Angeles than it was in Hong Kong. There were about a dozen of us voice actors in Hong Kong that primarily did all of the voice work for the past 10 to 15 years. There's only like 3 or 4 studios in Hong Kong that will do this kind of work. And they're the go-to people, the people that the directors know they can count on just to do the job and quickly and without any problem. When it first started out, there were 2 distinct teams. And it was kind of like the Coke and Pepsi of voice dubbing in Hong Kong. And you didn't dare go to the other team or be, you know, you'd be like the Judas of your group. So the people who led these dubbing groups were, you know, very strict about that. Like, you could not go in, even though you were freelancing, you actually no signed contract whatsoever. It was just a given rule. It was like the gentleman's agreement that you will not go and dub for the opposite team. Now, over the years, that kind of disappeared because what everyone kind of started to realize how silly that was. But also the main thing was that it went from when I first started doing it, it was really a 5 to 6 day a week job, which kept us very busy. So it was our full-time job. But over the years, a lot of that dubbing work left Hong Kong, and it went to places like mainland China, where they were starting to develop larger metropolis of Western speakers, whether it be in Shenzhen or in Shanghai, other places in Asia, which were basically undercutting Hong Kong being the go-to place for English dubbing in Asia. If you're a voice actor in Hong Kong, you just work for anybody that you possibly can.
When you're dubbing a movie in Hong Kong, or when you were dubbing a movie in Hong Kong, did you ever have any creative license to work with the English that they provided you?
Oh, yeah, because a lot of it was written so poorly that it was just like, did you even bother? Even today, when you're auditioning as an actor for these films, like say there's a random role for an English-speaking character in a Chinese film, they may not even have the script in English ready for you at audition. They may just like write something up and be like, that's good enough for the audition because we haven't even written something for you to say yet. And then on the day of or the day before or the couple days before, you as the actor are getting the language. And then they're asking you, you know, does that make sense? When you're dubbing, it depends on where that script is coming from. And you usually have a license for slight changes. For example, hey, you guys, you should not go there, to, hey, guys, don't go in there, if that fits the lips better. It used to be where you watch old kung fu movies and it was so bad where the lips weren't even close to matching what the people were saying. And today, you know, in 2020, dubbing has really become a completely different process, and everything is done digitally, and they make every effort to make the sound match the lips 100%. So if you as the actor or the director think changing the script will make it look better, then that is completely smiled upon.
Can you remember any differences between dubbing for like mainland films and Hong Kong films?
A lot of Hong Kong films may be produced or financed by the same people who are producing and financing mainland Chinese films,
right,
in a
right.
way. A lot of times it's same actors as well. I mean, not always, but I mean, there are 10 Hong Kong movie stars who are in every single Hong Kong movie. You know, I mean, how many times can you see a cop film by the same actor playing a cop, and but it's supposed to be a different cop?
I'll take more Andy Lau.
Yeah. You know, nothing against Andy Lau, but him and a lot of those guys are in every single movie, you know. Rewriting a script, to match the lips is an art form all in itself.
Has that process become more robust? Did you experience it change in any way over your 12 years, or is it like kind of, you know, depends on production?
To be honest, nowadays, now that I'm in LA for almost 2 years now, the majority of stuff that I dub is for things like Netflix and Hulu and stuff like that. And it's foreign stuff, mostly European and South American. And so I'm not really doing a lot of Asian stuff these past 2 years. But I mean, for the 10 years prior to that, or even before that, no, it was always hit or miss. And did they improve over time? No. I mean, it was the same shit 10 years ago that people are probably getting there now.
Are there any actors that you find yourself just dubbing over and over and over again throughout your career? Like, you just become the guy that does this guy?
There wasn't really like, oh, here's Jackie Chan, you're the Jackie Chan voice in English. Well, Jackie Chan. No, it was never like that. It was basically like, okay, Mike, this time you're going to play Jackie Chan. Oh, cool. Dave, you played it last time, remember? Yeah. And nobody really was, you know, designated, oh, you're the go-to guy for the Andy Lau voice. You know, that never happens. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit different, however, when you are doing American voices. I don't know if you guys have ever seen there's a great documentary I am George Clooney. It's all about people from all across the world who dub George Clooney's voice. Like, there's the guy in India who always does George Clooney, the guy in China who always does George Clooney. So it's weird because there's a level, there's a standard there when it comes to Hollywood films and Hollywood stars.
How close do you try to get to the original performance to recreating it in English?
If the character sounds really gruff and has a deep voice and a gravelly voice, then you want to put that gravel in there, the deepness in there. So you want to match that type of tone. But you're not trying to imitate it.
Do you remember how many characters you dubbed on this movie, Roto Tigers?
No, to be honest, it was quite a few various characters. Yeah.
So does that get like, so I'm just trying to understand the mechanics of that. Do you do each voice in sequence, or is it like, you know, you do one character and then take a break and do another character? Like, how does the scene roll out?
Yeah, well, they got you for a certain amount of time usually. So the way that, if I remember correctly, and different studios might handle it differently. Some might just start from the very beginning of the film, and then they just work their way until the film ends and then do it that way. Others, usually what they'll do is, let's say they have you for a 3-hour time slot. They'll do all of your specific character that you've been assigned. So say they've assigned me to a baker who has 3 different scenes and, you know, 4 lines. And then I play the brother-in-law who comes in and he's in like 4 or 5 different scenes. And then I play this guy. So they'll nail out those specific scenes first. Then they look at the clock and they say, all right, well, we got 40 minutes left. Let's go to this guy. He's selling apples on the street. He's got 2 lines. He just says, would you like to buy an apple, miss? Best ones in town. And so you just do that and you're just on the fly. So they just kind of like fill it up as you go. And you try to change up the voice a little bit each time. But when you have just one line here or one line there, those characters may know if you're paying attention, really, you may be sound like, oh, wow, the guy who just said that one line as a cab driver sounds exactly like the lead character in this film.
So when you were working on these films, did you get a sense of the expectation of how big these international audiences were supposed to be?
No, because a lot of times you wouldn't know if it was going to be a hit or not. I mean, so many of them are bombs, you know, you just have no clue. You know, Tigers actually did pretty good at the box office, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, basically Jackie's going to sell stuff and, you know, you do it. And you're just kind of like, well, I may never see this movie again. And it's funny because, you know, a lot of times, you know, Hollywood stars will pop into these films and think like no one's going to see this, and or at least hope that nobody sees it. Adrian Brody is one of those. Yeah. You know, John Cusack. A lot of these films, people do, you know, like Matt Damon in the Great Wall movie or whatever. And I think later on he was like, oh, shit, they're actually going to show this in the States now. My manager said that they would only show this in China. Yeah. crap. All right. Well, whatever.
Yeah. Purely out of curiosity, when you're watching a movie, do you prefer to watch a dub or would you rather watch it with subtitles?
It's funny enough. If I've dubbed it, I'd like to hear it so I can hear how our team did.
Yeah.
If not, no, I don't want to listen to a dub. I want to watch. I want to do subtitles. And it's fine. Yeah,
that's the question we need.
Honest truth. Right? No. I think I can enjoy anime in both the original and in the American or English versions equally. And I know that there's a lot of people who are like, you got to be a dubber or a subber. And there's no in between. Dubbers suck. No, subbers suck. And there's internet sites where people are just going back and forth at each other like, fuck you, dubbers, that one sucks, you know. And and when you get to, and there are certain write-ups that of shows that I've done and voices, and you know, people will be like, what the fuck was this guy, what was he thinking when he voiced the alien yellow frog with that voice? You know, it's like, well, what the hell is an alien yellow frog supposed to sound like? You know, it's like you're using your imagination as it comes up. I can appreciate both. I have a show on Netflix, Kengan Ashura. It's a very brutal, fight clubby type of show that's MMA style fighting, very bloody and gory. It was released on Netflix with 6 different languages all at the same time. Wow. So there's an English language, of course, the one that I participated in. And then there was a Japanese one that was released at the same time as well, and several other languages. But there are many people who are like, you got to listen to the original Japanese. And like, there was no original Japanese because it was all released at the same time, depending on where you were at. And, you know, I mean, I think that even in the States, your Netflix, there are some snobs out there who are like, subtitles only, please. I don't want to listen to some dub. But, you know, yeah, to each their own.
I think I fall into that camp, unfortunately.
But, you know, it all depends if it's done well or not. I think there's also a stereotype of, like, dub a lot. If it's done poorly, I mean, if it's a shitty dub, no. I mean, why would anyone want to watch a shitty dub? I mean, unless you're watching it strictly to laugh at while you're drunk with friends. Yeah. You know, I mean.
Like one of those old Bruce Lee movies with the 50s teenagers.
Yeah, exactly.
Those dubs are great, right? Like, because they last. And, like, that's what you want to see when you watch those movies. You want to see the kind of, you know, awful timing. Yeah. I don't know. It's like, that's how it always has been. And, like, I guess I'm a conservative when it comes to this kind of thing.
And the way that it was done back then, of course, it was a completely different process as well. I mean, those old kung fu films, you know, you're doing dubbing on, a tape. Yeah. So they're taping your voice, and then they're having to move that tape and slot it just right. And nowadays, with digital voice recording, they'd be like, okay, we're going to tweak your voice to make it a little bit quicker. Okay, the mouth flapped once too many times, so we're just going to stretch it out and stretch the words that you said, and now it fits perfectly. So, I mean, nowadays, dubbing really doesn't – in 2020, we don't have the excuse of – it not matching the lips. It has to match the lips.
Thank you, Yiwu and Michael Cipazuto, for being on the show. We have reached our final stop on this station. Last call, everybody get out.
This is the final
everybody
destination.
On the Hogwarts Express.
This is the final destination.
Our original music comes from Elliot Saltmarsh and Yehuda of Fist with a PH, and our art comes courtesy of Jay Castro.
Follow us on Twitter at China Film Pod, like the Oprah in the Studio Facebook page, and if you could afford it, we would really appreciate it if you'd contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com/Oprah in the Studio. This week, we are waiting for a train that will take us far away, and the rest of that Inception bit. Help out, and if you feel like it, have some thoughts or suggestions, email us at oprahinthestudio, all one word, @gmail.com.
Next week, we'll be talking about Kung Fu Yoga, but before we leave you this week, we just want to share some wisdom from the chairman.
To read too many books is harmful. We'll see you next week.